This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Of the many challenges facing astronauts living in space, how do you get regular exercise? How do you drink coffee? And yes, of course, the favorite, how do you go to the bathroom? One of the more unexpected consequences of spaceflight may be trouble reading the fine print. Yeah. Why does microgravity make you need a different prescription for your glasses? Lauren Silverman of KERA News in Dallas is here to talk about that and how doctors are trying to solve the problem, along with other selected short subjects in science this week. Welcome to Science Friday, Lauren.
Excited to be here.
We're very happy to have you. Let's talk about the problems the astronauts are having. This is something many astronauts have complained about, isn't it, having trouble reading in space?
Yeah, it's something that really has only been talked about more recently because it isn't something that happens to astronauts who just do a quick trip. But for people who are out on the International Space Station for long periods of time, say for 6 months, for example, they tend to have this problem. Their eyes are changing physically. Their vision is changing. And it doesn't happen to everyone, but most astronauts do notice that they become farsighted. It happened to an astronaut, Michael Barrett. He's also a doctor. And while he was up there, you know, flying hundreds of miles above Earth in 2009, he noticed his vision was changing. He was struggling to read manuals and checklists, which you can imagine are pretty important when you're up there on the ISS.
Details.
So he's going through manuals and checklists, and he's spending a lot of time on the Russian segment as well. So he's trying to read in Russian, in small print, in a pretty dark space, and his vision is changing. So when he finally lands back on Earth and he touches solid ground, he asks for something sort of strange, a hot shower and a spinal tap.
Let me back that up for a second.
A spinal tap.
what does a spinal tap, I'll ask the question, have to do with reading Russian?
Well, he wanted to find out whether the pressure around his brain had changed. And one way you can do that is by looking at the cerebrospinal fluid, hence getting the spinal tap. And that is the prevailing theory of why vision is changing. The idea is this. If you have no gravity, the fluid from your lower part of your body can migrate up into the brain instead of staying down towards your feet like it might on Earth. And that increases the pressure and reshapes the eyeballs.
Wow. And did he find that the pressure in his brain, did he get this spinal tap? Did he find that it actually had changed?
Well, he did, but the problem is he didn't have a reading from before he'd left, so it's pretty hard to compare by just looking at what happened after. So I talked with another researcher who's here in Dallas, Dr. Benjamin Levine, and he's been studying this pressure theory for years. And his newest publication shows that the pressure on the brain while people are in microgravity, zero gravity, it is higher than it is, say, when you or I are standing on Earth, but it's only slightly higher. It's not what they expected. So I think we have a clip of Dr. Levine explaining how he's had to modify this theory and come up with a pretty crazy sounding solution to try out.
So we now think that perhaps this mild but persistent pressure may be the thing that's stimulating remodeling behind the eye and causing the visual impairment. So one way to induce a gravity-like gradient is to encase the lower part of the body in a structure that's called lower body negative pressure. It's an old technique that's been around for more than 50 years, but we've been working with Under Armour, the garment company, to come up with a soft, almost like a sleeping sack or a pair of trousers that you can put on at night, hook up to a vacuum cleaner, suck the blood and the fluid into the feet, and unload the heart and the brain while you're sleeping.
Wow. Did they actually build this thing?
Well, they're working on it, and they've started to test these out. Of course, they need to test them on the International Space Station in order to figure out whether this could really work. But I asked Mike Barrett, the astronaut, who's also the doctor, and he said he'd be willing to pull on a pair and try them out.
You know, in the early days of rocketry and in the 50s, they used to create pressure suits were because the blood would drain out of your head. They were talking about blood pressure in those days, right? They didn't talk about spinal fluid. So this is sort of an idea, but using a different technique to increase that, to let you see better. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and it's interesting, though, because there are people who are on Earth who actually have problems related to pressure in their brain. So if this it could work to lower the pressure, it could be something that people who have traumatic brain injury, where there's also oftentimes an increase in brain pressure that's problematic, that other people here could use as well.
No, you know, that's interesting because they always talk about spin-offs from this space, you know, space race, Tang, and that stuff, and we might actually have something medical here. That's kind of interesting. Let's move on to another story about how deeply paralyzed people might be able to communicate beyond blinking their eyes. You've reported on that.
Yeah. So if you've read the book or seen the movie, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, you might know how difficult it can be for someone who's deeply paralyzed to communicate. Sometimes they can use eye muscles, and that creates the chance for them to be able to blink and sort of spell things out that way. But it's pretty hard to communicate if someone can't even control blinking. So researchers in Europe have been developing a method to do that. And this week they published a paper in the journal PLOS Biology showing that they've managed to communicate with several patients who are in a complete locked-in state. And they did it with something that looks a little bit like a swimming cap, a high-tech swimming cap. And it measures electrical waves from the brain and blood flow. And the first thing they had to do was put on this swim cap on the patients and calibrate it. So they had to ask the patients yes or no questions. You know, is Paris the capital of France? What's your name? Is your name Martha? Whatever it might have been. And figure out the correct answers, whether they were getting the correct answers. And they got them about 70% of the time, which is better than chance.
Wow.
So that was shocking. And then they started to ask them more open-ended questions, one of which was, are you happy? And the people then could respond. And the people who they asked, who were only a few patients who have ALS, said yes. So you can imagine what that might have been like for family members who haven't had any communication at all.
And it's interesting because we hear stories about experiments where people have had the same sort of similar situation. They have pro electrodes on their heads and they try to move a muscle in their arms or a robotic muscle and learning how to succeed in doing just thinking about something and then it happens. Maybe this is sort of that same
thing. Yeah. Trying to go beyond visible muscle movements to sort of what's below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to a Pew Research Center has a new survey out which suggests most parents around the country actually are in favor of vaccinating school-age kids. If you listen to some news reports, you would never believe that.
Yeah, and this study was interesting because it looked at more than 1,500 people across the U.S. So it looked at Americans in general and how they feel about the requirement for school-age children to get vaccinated, specifically for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, which is the one that's often in the news. And the Pew report shows that more than 80% of Americans do support a school-based vaccine requirement. But about 17% say parents should be able to decide not to vaccinate, even if that means creating health risks for others.
Hmm. Do they offer any alternative of what they would do, or they were not asked that question?
They weren't asked that, but if you look at the breakdown, what's interesting is that older people, older Americans who don't necessarily have children who are of the age 0 to 4 where they might need to be getting vaccinated, are much more in support of a requirement than younger Americans.
Yeah, well, because a lot of us old enough to remember the polio vaccine and what you know, and iron lungs and things like that. So we know what the consequences of not getting vaccination could be.
That could be. And they saw also that people who are more science literate, maybe people who listen to more Science Friday, seem to see the benefits much more outweighing the risks of vaccines.
I want to talk about your last story called Saffron in Vermont. We're not talking maple syrup here. This
No.
What they're growing saffron in Vermont?
Yes, it sounds very strange, which is why it caught my attention. The state may be trying to move beyond cheese and craft beer and maple syrup. So basically what's happened is that saffron is extremely expensive. It's a spice that's worth more than gold. It costs up to about $5,000 per pound. And right now, most saffron, about 80%, comes from Iran. But there's a team at the University of Vermont who's developing a process for growing the spice in Vermont, and get this, in winter. So what they're doing is planting saffron in Vermont's greenhouses, which are high tunnels. They call them high tunnels there. And they're unheated greenhouses that the farmers use for other crops like tomatoes most of the year. But there are a few months when there are neither greens nor tomatoes that are up in those high tunnels. And during those few months, this Iranian postdoc tried planting saffron, and he got a phenomenal yield of the spice.
Wow, because that really is expensive stuff. You're right. It's
hundreds
of dollars.
So maybe.
Wow.
So they could make some maybe paella or something else that needs some saffron in there coming from Vermont. But they've got to convince people to pick the stigmas from the saffron, which is really delicate and time-consuming process.
Well, with a price like that, I'm sure they'll get people to do that. And I'm waiting for that first. I want to see that crop of saffron in Vermont. Thank you, Lauren. It's good to have you. We'll have you back. Lauren Silverman. Health science and technology reporter at KERA News in Dallas. Thanks for joining
us. Yeah, thank you.
We're going to take a break, and coming up, researchers have created a pig-human chimera. We'll take a look at what it could mean for transplant patients. Could we grow body parts in pigs, human body parts, and then harvest them for when we need them? Well, they're making steps in that direction. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Human stem cell research is often in the crosshairs of Washington politics. It's characterized by its detractors as monstrous and unethical, or considered too polarizing to deal with. But two groundbreaking studies published this last week highlighted the promise and importance of stem cell research to human medicine. At Stanford University, scientists were able to grow a mouse pancreas inside of a rat, creating sort of a rat-mouse hybrid known in mythology as Chimera. Other researchers were able to show for the first time ever that human cells could live inside a pig embryo. Sounds like science fiction, right? But it is not some Frankenstein's monster. There's a surprising real-world application here. To grow replacement organs in animals, organs to give to transplant patients who need them. Joining me now to discuss this are my next two guests. Chow Zhou is associate professor in the Department of Stem Cell and Regenerative Biology at Harvard, and Jun Wu is staff scientist at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. Dr. Wu, Dr. Zhou, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Dr. Wu, when someone hears that researchers are creating chimeras in the lab, it sounds like science fiction. Explain to me why researchers are doing this work.
So the ultimate goal and the motivation behind this research is that there is a worldwide shortage of organ donors. And in United States alone, there's over 100,000 people on the waiting list for available donor organs. We scientists, especially stem cell scientists, are trying to use a very unique cell type called pluripotent stem cells that has the potential to generate all the cells in our body. And in theory, it can also generate three-dimensional tissues and organs. But that potential hasn't been realized in a culture dish, which we normally culture the cells. And we saw that the animals and humans are generating organs and tissues every day. In a very precise manner, for example, a mouse from one single cell to a born organism, it takes only 19 days. And the cells know exactly where to go and what to become in the specific organs or tissues. So we're thinking, why not use the animal, a developing animal, to guide the human stem cells to generate the specific tissues and organs that we can use in the future for transplant?
So you were able to get human cells to grow inside a pig, in a pig embryo at that point. How far did you let it go to development?
So in the current study, we stopped the experiment between 3 weeks to 4 weeks into pig's gestation, which is about one-third of the entire gestation of the pig, around 112 or 114 days. So during this period of time, we think it's enough to gather some information to know which type of human proponent stem cell can survive and contribute to early developing pig embryos so that they can become early progenitors that later on can generate the organs and tissues.
Do you know how to direct the stem cells yet to generate the organs and tissues that you want?
Not with the human pig study at this stage, but with the rat and mice study, also including this paper, we demonstrated that with the strategy that originally developed in 2010 by Hiro Nakaguchi's group, which we call it interspecies process complementation, which we can disable a particular organ or tissue development in the host animal, for example, a mouse. So the mouse doesn't generate a pancreas, a heart, etc. And we can use the red stem cells to populate that niche, basically can enrich the red stem cell in the specific organs so that we can have a more or less the red cell enriched organs for transplantation.
And Dr. Joe,
but with the human, we haven't...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But with the human, this is a very first study. We just want to know whether human cells can survive in there. And for the next step, we'd like to use the same strategy to disable the development of a particular organ in the pig so that we can see whether human cells can be enriched in that organ.
Dr. Joe, following up on Dr. Wu's talking about the mouse-rat study, you wrote a companion piece in Nature about that study. What is the important part of that study where they, just to repeat, that they were able to get mouse cells to grow inside the rat?
Yes, indeed. So I wrote a commentary about the article published in Nature from Dr. Nakaguchi's lab at Stanford and also in Japan. So that study basically demonstrated you can grow a mouse pancreas inside a rat. And now you can subsequently harvest the mouse pancreas that is growing in the rat and isolate the pancreatic islets that contains insulin-secreting cells. You can isolate that part of the pancreas, now transplant into a diabetic mouse and be able to cure the diabetes of the mouse. So I think this is a very interesting demonstration of how these interspecies organ growth can be used to treat disease.
Were those pancreatic cells actually tested out in a diabetic mouse? Were they transplanted?
Exactly. I think that's the main breakthrough, I would say, a major step forward, because the same research group from Stanford in Japan, Nakaguchi's group, have demonstrated some years ago that you can generate an interspecies pancreas between these two different rodent species, but they didn't do the transplantation and diabetes rescue step. So in this particular study, they now demonstrated that this is feasible.
Diabetes, if I'm correct, is an autoimmune disease, which means the body attacks itself, right? I mean, how do you, even if you get new islets from the pancreas, and how do you stop the process of the body again attacking those new cells?
Right. So this particular form of diabetes that the authors have treated, the mouse model of diabetes, is type 1 diabetes. This is autoimmune disease. But type 1 diabetes represents only a relatively minor subpopulation of the total diabetes patient population out there. So the majority of people, diabetic patients, are so-called type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is not an autoimmune attack. But coming back to your question, now in type 1 diabetes patients, now we have we can get new beta cells, but if you transplant the new beta cells into this autoimmune environment, these new beta cells will again be subjected to autoimmune attack.
Yeah.
So people have to figure out ways how to protect them. For example, using immunosuppressive drugs that's currently used clinically to do this.
Mm. So have they done that, successfully protected the cells?
They have. In fact, yes. In fact, for many years, for decades, pancreatic insulin-secreting beta cells and islets have been harvested from deceased donors and transplanted to people that are suffering from type 1 diabetes. And then using immunosuppressants, these transplant recipients have been able to basically live a pretty normal life for decades, years and decades. So it works, that we know. But there are basically very little source of these transplantable islets available. So now the idea is, how can we get these islets, perhaps through interspecies organ production, as Dr. Wu has just talked about.
Dr. Wu, how far can you go now? How further along can you allow the embryo to try to develop further and actually create a human body part?
This is the very first step toward that goal and toward the dream to generate the human organs inside the pig. And in this study, we stopped very early due to several reasons. One of them is that in California, our protocol only allows us to go to no more than 4 weeks into the pig gestation. And in Spain, we also have approval to actually go right before birth, but we choose not to. The reason why is, at the very early stages, we can study how the human cells are migrate or integrate and what type of tissues they can contribute, so that we can develop better strategy and an even safer strategy for the organ production in the future. As you're probably aware, there are some ethical concerns related to this topic, and one of the tissues we don't want human cells to contribute, for example, is the brain and germline tissue. And by studying this very early stages, we can develop strategies to prevent the human cells from going to the brain, from going to the germline, and specifically guide them into a particular tissues and organs they want them to be.
Yeah. Well, what would be your first choice and the kind of tissue and organ you'd like to produce first? What would be the best candidate? I imagine the most simple one would be.
I think the pancreas is a good candidate.
Yeah.
The reason for that is that we don't necessarily need a whole organ. We can isolate the beta cells on islet, and even we can isolate those cells at the fetal stage, they probably perform better than the adult cell type. So I would go for the pancreas as the first proof of concept.
Mm-hmm. And you say you're going to probably go because of ethical considerations in this country and limits on research, you'll probably work further in Spain on this?
After we gather more information, and at this stage of this study, I think the contribution of the human cell is still too low, lower than we expected. The next step would be to develop strategy to enhance the human cells a better percentage in terms of chimerism in the developing pig embryos, but at the same time control the human cells not to go to tissues that we don't want to be.
How do you do that? How do you prevent it from turning into brain tissue?
So there are several strategies. You can do this by genetically or epigenetically. For example, you can disable the master regulator for the brain development in the donor human cells. You can take out the gene, you can inactivate a particular gene, so the human cell don't have the ability to go to the brain. The other strategy is to implement what we call it a safety switch. Basically, if the human cells contribute to the brain development, then the brain cells from the human donor cell will self-destruct, will not go further. And most recently, we in our lab, we are developing a strategy that we can epigenetically basically change the DNA methylation status of some of the brain master regulators so that the human cells, donor human cells, will doesn't have the ability to develop into the brain tissue.
Let me ask Dr. Wu, what can your work or the work that you're reporting about it in the journal commenting about, what can that contribute to what Dr. Wu is doing with the pigs and the humans development?
There are some important information we can get from these type of studies. For example, what Dr. Wu is doing at the Salk Institute is, as he mentioned, is actually in fact, subject to a bit of constraints because of the ethical and potentially legal concerns. So these type of studies also cannot use federal funding. You have to come, get resources to carry out this type of research. Whereas in animal studies, I think you can ask different types of questions, more in-depth questions. For example, one thing has come up from generating Dr. Wu's work, basically generating, trying to make the human cells contribute to pig embryos. What has been observed and reported is that the contribution is relatively poor. That is, there are some type of unknown species barriers that prevents the human cells to contribute robustly to the pig embryos. The same type of species barriers can also be seen between rat and mouse. So if we understand these species barriers and be able to identify them, study them, we might be able to, for example, lower these species barriers so that the human cells can better contribute to an animal embryo as a step towards eventual goal of getting transplantable human organs.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Jun Wu, staff scientist at the Salk Institute, and also talking to Chow Zhou, associate professor in the Department of Stem Cell and Regenerative Biology at Harvard. How does the atmosphere, the sense of of research and science in America these days affect the research going forward? Are any of you concerned about whether funds for this type of research will be cut off in the new administration?
So for this study, we didn't use any fund from the federal government, as this, all the funding are provided by private source. And we are hopeful that our published work can help the policymakers to evaluate whether this is a valuable research direction to go forward. And I think it's important to come up with a step-by-step approach and to evaluate the ethical, technical, and scientific challenges that we need to overcome before we do we go further. I'm hopeful that after our published results, that provides some new information regarding how the interspecies chimeric formation using the human cells, how low the contribution is, and at this stage, I believe that the ethical concern is not a big issue. But if we go forward, this type of research will for sure generate some of the concerns, but we can stop and we can develop a strategy to prevent that from happening at this stage.
Well, it all sounds very exciting, very interesting. This must be a fertile ground for research, and we always hear of new things happening in this kind of work. So I want to thank both of you and wish you good luck, and please be. Don't be afraid to come back and tell us when you have something new to report.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You're welcome. Chow Zhou is associate professor in the Department of Stem Cell and Regenerative Biology at Harvard University. And Jun Wu is staff scientist at the famous Salk Institute for Biological Studies. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about astrobiology, looking for life somewhere out there. If you want to look for life, how do you know what to look for? I mean, what if it's not like life on Earth here? Well, their scientists have created laboratories to simulate where, life might be living on these icy moons of, Jupiter and Saturn. If you go there and we think there might be life under the ice of Europa Enceladus, how do you know if you find it? We'll talk about it, and if you'd like to, you can give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We have learned that water can be found in many places in our solar system, of course, not just on Earth. And with each of these discoveries of water on Mars, Europa, Enceladus, the likelihood increases of some kind of life existing out there, too. You know the old saying, if there's water, there might be life. But how do you plan a mission to look for that if you don't know what it might look like? I mean, it might not be like the kind of life you and I are used to here. Well, for the rest of the hour, we're going to hope to find out. We're going to be talking astrobiology. That's what they call the search for life in outer space there, astrobiology, and how environments on our own Earth could serve as a useful analog for searching for life on distant worlds. And if you want to join our conversation, please give us a call. Doesn't matter which part of the universe you live in, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. So if you're calling from Saturn, don't reverse the charges on this one. Let me introduce, first up, my guest joining me now is someone who's been out to one of the labs that is planning for missions to some of those icy worlds, our own Chow Tu, who has written an article on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can read her article, and there's a video about the lab that she visited on our website at sciencefriday.com. Welcome, Chow.
Hi, Ira.
So you went out to watch where they're, what are they doing? They're trying to recreate the icy world of these moons?
Yeah, so there's a smallish lab at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And they are focused, they're called the Icy World Simulation Lab. So they're focused on simulating the surfaces of icy worlds in mostly our outer solar system. And I like to call it kind of an idea lab because they're essentially coming up with creative sort of MacGyver-like experiments to make these simulations. It was really fascinating to visit.
What do you mean MacGyver? I saw that they sort of jerry-rigged their original project together. Tell me what that was looked so, like. What did they do?
Yeah, so one of the experiments that I saw them working on was it was this stock pot, basically something that you can make gumbo in. And they had sort of a foam that was duct taped to the outside, and they put liquid nitrogen in there, and that was kind of them growing ice. They were sort of trying to simulate what the ice on Europa is like and trying to figure out what the surface is like.
So why is Europa a good choice for trying?
So Europa is a big focus for NASA and JPL right now, mostly because we believe that there could be an Earth-like ocean underneath its ice shell. There is a mission planned for around 2022 to launch a spacecraft that would do multiple flybys of the moon, and so we can get a better look to see about what's going on there.
Yeah, it's for looking at the video. Also, we have a video up on our website about this. The ice is very thick.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
yeah.
Europa is about, 20 kilometers or something like
that?
Yeah,
I think the ice shell is supposed to be about 20 kilometers, and I think the ocean underneath it would be about 100 kilometers. So,
wow.
Still pretty big in comparison to Earth's ocean, but yeah.
Yeah, and what we learned from Earth's ocean is that you don't have to have light because the light is not going to get below that ice level,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
You don't have to have light for life. We have these, at the bottom of the oceans and the Earth, there is no light, but we have sources of heat, right,
mm-hmm.
that come up and support life that never sees light.
Right, right. So just a lot of what they're trying to study right now is how we might be able to further land on the surface and study it and then figure out what's underneath.
Wow. So let's talk about the lab you visited. How big a chunk of ice of an icy world? I mean, you said they started out with a stockpot.
Yeah, yeah.
Did they keep it a stockpot? Were they able to get a little more expensive
yeah,
equipment
so
into their work?
They've graduated now to another sort of experiment. It's a lot fancier, I guess you can say. They've kind of dubbed it the Ark of Europa, kind of after the Indiana Jones Ark. But it's now this kind of vacuum-sealed stainless steel chamber. And inside there, they are still growing ice.
Yeah.
They're sort of simulating those sorts of that sort of environment. And yeah, they're just becoming a little bit more, they can sort of make sure that all their measurements are more accurate working with that.
Now, as I saw from the pictures on our website, the ice doesn't look like the kind of ice you think you're walking mm-hmm. on your driveway.
Right.
Does it? It comes in all shapes and different forms.
Right. So again, we don't really know what Europa's surface is like, so that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to see what might grow there. There's an idea, there's a theory that there's these things called penitentes that might form on Europa, and these are actually really common on Earth here in the Andes Mountains. And they're kind of like big ice stalagmites, so just like huge sort of upside-down icicles that are coming from the ground. So they're trying to see if they can grow these, because if they do grow in Europa, that would kind of change how we would, you know, build a lander or know how to land on the surface of Europa, or even how to scan the surface using a radar.
You know, it reminded me when we were thinking about going to the moon originally back in the Apollo days. People thought, you know, you might sink in. It might be just a bunch of dust there. And if you land on there, you're going to sink right through, because we had never been there. Mm-hmm. And we have never been to these planets.
Right.
We've never been to the moons of these planets. So we don't know what kind of ice we might find there. And if, you know, we don't know what, if we send some sort of robot at there, we don't want it to fall into the ice,
right? Exactly. Yeah. These stalagmites or upside down icicles are there. It's not exactly flat. So we wouldn't be able to send like a normal type of spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. Do they have their ideas? What's the goal? Let me go back to the most basic information here. Yeah. Will any mission actually change based on what they find in the lab, or how will they, you know, recreate as close as possible to what these moons are like?
Yeah. So a lot of the work that they're doing is sort of informing about the types of tools and the types of spacecraft that we might be able to send there. So right now there's a mission plan to do flybys. There's not a mission plan for a lander quite yet, but it's very possible. And they want to be prepared for that, for any sort of scenario.
Well, thank you, Chow, to help us flesh this out a little more. We were going to bring a mission scientist in before we go, and I want to thank you, speaking for a staff. I know that this is your last.
It is.
We're bidding you a fond farewell. You're going to be moving on.
I am going to be moving on, but my heart will always be with Science Friday.
Well, take a little bit of our heart with you. You know, we want to thank you for all your hard work and good cheer.
Thank you, Ira. That's very sweet.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Mary Wojtek is the senior scientist in astrobiology at NASA's Science Mission Directorate, and she is based at NASA HQ, as they say, in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. I'm glad to be here.
It's glad that we could get you on here. tell us about the missions to these. Why are these moons chosen? Why do we think that's the best place to possibly find life?
Well, Ira, as you know, it's been NASA's focus as a fundamental requirement of life to look for environments that have water. That's pretty key. And of the moons that we know anything about around Saturn and Jupiter, there's an estimate about them having about 30 times the amount of water that we see on Earth if you combine them all together. So that seems like a very rich place to go to look for life that requires water.
Hmm. And how confident are you that life elsewhere in the solar system will have a chemistry of our own? I mean, we were talking at the beginning about how do you look for life that may not be, you know, recognizable easily here on Earth?
You've come to the crux of the problem in searching for life. A lot of our studies certainly began with understanding as much as we could about what life we have here on Earth, and it's fully appreciating its diversity. It was really important to decide what sorts of crooks and niches that it inhabits here on Earth. And as a result, we've realized that there's a huge diversity of places that you can find life, although the solution to it in terms of chemistry and acquiring energy is diverse, it's still pretty fundamentally similar amongst all organisms on Earth. So when you go to look for life elsewhere, you can certainly prepare yourself by understanding as much as you can about the one sample example that we have. But we can also start trying to think more about biology or life more universally. What sort of things can we imagine they might need? We know that they'd have to have energy. We know that it turns out that life leaves its mark and on planets and environments as it uses the resources that it needs to make cells to gain energy. And so we've sort of shifted a little bit to start thinking more broadly about what would those signs of or evidence of life be if we didn't know exactly what it looked like or what chemistry it was doing? Could we look for, unexplainable aspects of the chemistry that we would measure that can only happen if there's something like life working on it? And so it's a difficult problem, but we are trying to think about it to get the best value out of the missions when we go looking for life.
So are you saying that you're looking for residues that life would leave behind without actually having to identify what the life is?
Well, we plan on having, first of all, we have learned that you don't just rely on one thing.
Yeah.
And so we're going to look for the things that would be obvious. You know, if we knew it was exactly like Earth life, what would you use? What tools would you use? Would you select? What measurements would you make to identify Earth-like life somewhere else? And then we're trying to also see if those instruments can't also look more broadly and look for changes in an environment in terms of its chemistry, for example, that would indicate that life was present. Let me give you an example. We know that life begins with begins with using carbon and uses it in many forms, structurally, for energy, for basic machinery. And in doing so, some of the pieces that it uses are quite simple, but ultimately, some of the molecules that it makes to function in the cell are very complex. And so just generically, we might expect that if you saw a suite of organic compounds, that if they were all very simple, we know that those can be made without biology, but if they're very complex with lots of innovations in terms of their structure, and that would possibly be a sign of or evidence for life having acted and produced those particular molecules.
We have a lot of people asking one simple question, and so many of us have watched Star Trek and other science fiction movies. We're up. I'm going to go to the phones and let Renee in Cleveland ask the question. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Ira. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was wondering, is assuming that life is carbon-based, or that we're, that it would be making complex carbon molecules, is that just extrapolating from what we know about life on Earth? Is that showing any kind of lack of imagination in terms of what other living organisms would be capable of? Or are we pretty much determined that it's carbon all the way?
let me just first say, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And Dr. Wojtek, she reflects about half a dozen tweets that have come in also saying, could it not be carbon-based? What if it's something else? Would we recognize it?
Well, I think certainly any instruments that we sent up that were based on carbon would miss that signal. And we're very worried about what we call false negatives. We don't want to miss it. So some of the things that we're looking for is potentially, like I mentioned before, an unusual usage of materials that we could imagine could be used. Carbon is something that we focus on because, of course, here on life, it's used for everything in the cell. And many of the functions that go on in the cell, our scientists have found difficult to imagine as an efficient and useful element as carbon. And so it's not that we don't think about that. We're always going to, silicon is the obvious thing. Is there a horse out there? But we don't, and if there was, I mean, we are also sending instruments that are looking at mineralogy. So we would pick up things like silicon. And we might be able to see from the pattern of its usage or the distribution in a sample that this would be consistent with there potentially being a life form. Mm-hmm. It would be much harder for us to confirm that since we would know so little about that, but we would start getting clues that might be something we need to pursue further. But you guys have asked the most important, as I mentioned, the most important question or troubling question or challenge for us is, how do we look for what we don't know? And if it's there and we're not looking, are we going to see it? So it's truly a challenge.
Yeah. We have a shout out from Bob Akferdousi, who is listening and says, excited and fortunate to work with these wonderful people exploring strange icy worlds on NASA Europa. He tweeted that in today, so we want to shout out to Bobak. Let's go to let's see if I can get another phone call in. Let's go to Greg in Sacramento. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Ira. Great show. Love your work, man. Just a question for your guest. Is there like a Star Trek prime directive? If you do find life, at what point do you break off and say it's better that we leave it alone? You know, if you do find life, just curious. I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks. Is there a directive?
Well, we have something called planetary protection. That in its grossest sense, let's say, pays attention to making sure that we don't take contaminants of any sort to another planet that might potentially interfere with life going on there. And we also worry about, bringing anything back. I think it is a goal of ours to find it. We want to find it in situ if we can. We want to find it in samples that we bring back. And I think that we want to do it not at the expense of the actual organisms or, population. That's how we sample things on our planet in general. We want to understand it, but we certainly wouldn't want to eradicate it or interfere to any great extent with its thriving.
Well, it sounds exciting. Can't wait for that probe, which is a few years away, I'm sure, before it takes off. Mary Wojtek, senior scientist in astrobiology, NASA's Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington. Thank you. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Lou Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers, spinning the dial here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.